This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State and author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. This is the Freedom Show. And during the next 3 hours, we're going to be celebrating Americans who stand up for freedom against the powers of government. We'll be consulting with some of the nation's wisest citizens, James Madison, George Washington, and some of our contemporaries, such as Ambassador John Bolton, Congressman Louis Gohmert from Texas, a brave scientist who will not be cowed by the global warming religion, James Taylor from the Heartland Institute, and we'll even be talking with one of the candidates who is determined to turn the blue state of Connecticut back toward freedom by lowering taxes, restoring gun rights, and attracting businesses that have long fled that high-tax state. So we've got a lot ahead, but first, the headlines, and there are some real whoppers this morning. The IRS is paying $1 million in bonuses to IRS workers who owe back taxes. Think about that. It's unbelievable. The IRS has paid almost $3 million in bonuses to employees. It says these employees have disciplinary problems that range from drug abuse to misconduct on the job to fraudulently claiming unemployment benefits, but they're still getting a bonus. The IRS admits that when they award bonuses to their employees, they do not take into consideration the employee's conduct or job performance. That's a head scratcher. I'm laughing because this came out only in a Inspector General's report, a U.S. Treasury Inspector General's report. Otherwise, we might not have known about the millions of dollars going to IRS employees who are not doing their job. And then the IRS responded in typical government newspeak by saying the IRS is generally considering revising its policy. In the past, it does not consider, quote, conduct issues when administering awards. Unbelievable. Next in the headlines, just more proof that government is not on your side. President Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder have announced that in the coming months, they will be releasing prematurely, before their sentences are served, a steady flow of felons, drug dealers, drug doers, and others who have not served their sentences and under current federal guidelines would not yet be eligible for release. The president has long griped that the federal drug laws and drug sentences were unjust and too long. But instead of working through Congress as our Constitution requires, he's decided to take this on himself and simply open the prison doors. Another sign of lawlessness in Washington. Here's some good news. Governor Rick Perry, one of the finest governors in the United States, is ripping the federal government for its out-of-control land seizure policies. The same Bureau of Land Management that spawned the confrontation with Cliven Bundy in Nevada just 2 weeks ago is now snooping around and making plans to claim $90,000 of land and make it part of the public domain in Texas. Of course, the government has issued disclaimers saying we're just investigating, but Rick Perry has made it clear, not in Texas. The federal government, of course, does not have a monopoly on, contrary to common wisdom, behavior, let's put it that way. There's a banning mania going on in Washington and in New York City. Mayor Bill de Blasio, the newly elected, extremely left-wing mayor of New York City, vowed that he would end one of New York's trademarks, horse and carriage rides through Central Park. He claims it's inhumane for a horse to have to pull a carriage. Even animal rights groups disagree with him. But nevertheless, he's dug in his heels, dug in his hooves, perhaps, on this one. He's also announced just yesterday that he's going to ban wood-burning fireplaces in New York City. That won't affect too many people. It's a luxury in New York to have a wood-burning fireplace. But imagine the government snooping in and deciding you can't burn wood in your fireplace anymore. And the banning mania has hit Washington, of course, once again. A group of Democrats in Congress want to imitate New York City and ban the use of e-cigarettes around the Capitol. Now, here's what's really telling about this. The members of Congress, all Democrats, who have written a letter asking for this ban, concede that they have absolutely no evidence that e-cigarettes are harmful. But they argue, taking what they call the precautionary principle, they argue that it's an appropriate precautionary step to ban e-cigarettes at the Capitol. What's really amazing about this precautionary principle, which already has a firm lock on Europe, the precautionary principle says anything should be banned if you don't know whether it's safe or unsafe. You don't need any evidence that it's unsafe. Anything that's new is by definition unexplored, uninvestigated, and therefore subject to the precautionary principle. Imagine how human beings could have made any progress living their lives according to that principle. And now some really inspiring news. Yesterday, three American doctors were gunned down in an Afghanistan hospital. Unfortunately, an Afghan security guard opened fire on the group of doctors as they were walking to work in the morning, also wounding a nurse. Here's what's inspiring about this otherwise awful incident. The news report reads, the gunman was wounded and now is in surgery at the hospital. To me, what this says is, look at the medical profession. Under attack, injured, and yet doing everything they can to save the life of a wounded individual, even when that human being is the one who assaulted them to begin with. Takes your breath away. Well, those are some of the headlines. But the big headline is the battle for the blue states in the coming election. And we're getting ready to talk to one of those candidates in just a few minutes. But I wanted to set the stage for you by giving you some tax day information on exactly what we're facing. I don't know whether you've ever heard of tax day, but tax day is the day of the year, tax freedom day, it's technically called, when you can stop working for Uncle Sam and your state treasurer and your local tax collector and actually keep the money you earn. The Tax Freedom Institute calculates this day every year, adding in federal, state, and local taxes, and then dividing that total burden by the average salary of the American worker. Now, way back in 1900, Americans only had to work until January 22nd to pay their total taxes for the year. And from that day forth until the end of the year, December 31st, they were working for themselves and their family. Oh, how things have changed. Now the average American has to work till April 21st. Never mind that you file your taxes on April 15th. You're still toiling. You're still giving the fruits of your labor to government until April 22nd, on average. But boy, averages obscure big differences. If you live in the highest tax states, Connecticut, New Jersey, and New York, you are still working for the tax collector until May. In Connecticut and New Jersey till May 9th, according to the Tax Institute. In New York till May 4th. But if you live in Texas, you only work for the tax collector till April 13th. After that, it all goes in your pocket. In Louisiana, it's only March 30th. Now, why did I pick those states? Well, Governor Rick Perry is the governor of Texas. He's considered a presidential hopeful this time around. Louisiana's Bobby Jindal, also in that race. But look at New Jersey. May 9th. Residents of New Jersey on average have to work till May 9th just to pay the tax collector. So why is Chris Christie considered a front runner? Now, I know he's got a great personality, engaging personality. He's like the Snooki of politics. But I'm wondering, looking at his record, whether he's really a fiscal Republican. We're going to talk more about this after the break when we meet a man who's running for governor of Connecticut against the incumbent Democratic governor, Daniel Malloy. And we'll talk more about taxes. There is a lot to say, but the fact is we're all working too long for the tax collector and keeping too little for ourselves. This is Betsy McCoy, author of Beating Obamacare, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction. Give us a call, 855-40-LAURA. Talking about freedom. I'm
talking about freedom. The Laura Ingraham Show. Call the Laura Ingraham Show, 1-855-40-LAURA.
Glad you stayed with me, Bubala. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA. And just before the break, we were talking about who's in the running on the presidential for the presidential race on the Republican side. And I was raising an issue, really, and I'd love your feedback on this. Why is Chris Christie considered a front runner? He's got a bigger than life personality, no pun intended. He's affable. As I said, he's the Snooki of politics, and that's not considered a disparaging comment. You have to have a big personality to stand out in a race like this. But take a look at the fiscal statistics. Tax day is May 9th in New Jersey. New Jersey residents are toiling longer to pay the tax collectors than residents of virtually any other state in the country, except New Jersey and Connecticut, except Connecticut. And worse than that, I noticed that just a few days ago, New Jersey's credit rating got whacked by Standard & Poor's. They claimed that they were downgrading New Jersey's credit rating because the state's budget had not been managed properly, and New Jersey was not reducing spending enough to correct its, what they call in accounting land, structural imbalances. In other words, it was living beyond its means and then selling things to make up the difference. Compare New Jersey with a state like Wisconsin, where Scott Walker has really, he faced a huge deficit when he came into office, $3.6 billion, and he has whittled away and now has a surplus in his state. So you can understand why Scott Walker is a real contender for president. He knows how to manage spending in a state, especially a state besieged by public employee unions. That's a problem that I believe Chris Christie is facing in New Jersey as well. But give me your feedback. Why do you think Chris Christie is in the lead or close to the lead in this presidential horse race when his state has the highest tax burden in the nation and he's undergoing the same kind of downgrading that Barack Obama has allowed to happen to the federal credit rating? I don't like to see our nation's credit rating downgraded, and I wouldn't want to see our states as well. Not only that, but of course, an important concern for Republicans, value for Republicans, is the Second Amendment. And the Chris Christie administration is actually going to court in a battle against the NRA and the right of New Jersey residents to carry handguns outside their home. That's right. The New Jersey Attorney General is arguing that the right to bear arms means only the right to bear arm inside your home, except in extraordinary conditions, such as if you've already been attacked. And that's not the way that most of us read the Second Amendment. So I'd like to hear your views on Chris Christie. This gun case is particularly interesting. I think almost anybody reading about it would sympathize with the plaintiff. That's the man who brought the suit. He's now backed by the NRA and scores of states around the country. He purchased 50 ATM machines when he retired. He's an older man with no criminal record. And he went to get a gun permit so that he could protect himself when he was loading his ATM machines with cash. And New Jersey said that wasn't a good enough reason, that unless you've already been attacked or brutalized, you don't have a good enough reason to carry a gun. That kind of whittles your rights down to only a few people in a big state. So this case is now awaiting a decision by the Supreme Court on whether it will hear the case, and I believe that that decision will come out tomorrow. So we're all hoping that the United States Supreme Court will actually rule on what the right to bear arms means. Does it mean only to have a gun inside your home? Or, as the word bear connotes, the right to carry that gun when you leave your home? After all, as the right was written into the Bill of Rights, it said, in order to have a militia, and I don't usually find the militia in the kitchen, militias exercised and were formed outside of the home. So history suggests that the right to bear arms extends outside of the home, and that history is on the side of John Drake, the owner of these ATMs, who is awaiting his opportunity to go to the Supreme Court and defend his Second Amendment liberties. But that puts Chris Christie again in the spotlight. When we get back, we'll be talking to a candidate for governor in the Nutmeg State, Connecticut, running against the incumbent, Dan Malloy. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction.
Call the Laura Ingraham Show, 1-855-40-LAURA.
Thanks for staying with me, Bubba. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. And we've been talking about whether Chris Christie is really GOP presidential material, and I've got Steve from Houston on the line. Steve, let me start out by saying I love Texas.
Oh, thanks. Me too.
So tell me what you think.
Yeah, you were asking why you thought Christie had this status as a front runner, and I think a lot of it at this point has to do with the fact that people just see him speaking out very straightforwardly and just not letting him get pushed around by the media. Like when they had the Bridgegate discussions going on, There was a case where one reporter in particular kept trying to insist that he was such good friends with somebody who had been implicated in the wrongdoing, and he would just flat out tell them, no, that's not true, and I think that's attractive to a lot of people.
You're making a really good point, Steve, and not only that, but I hear just from people who see Christie up close, and I've done that myself, had dinner with him a couple of times in groups. And he is a very straightforward, believable person. I like him tremendously, and I hope he will come on this show. We've got time open tomorrow. I would love to hear more about his story, about what he would do as president, because when I look at his record in New Jersey, his growth, employment growth in New Jersey is less than half what it is nationwide. So he's got poor growth. He's got the highest tax burden in the nation. His state's credit rating has recently been downgraded, and he's lousy on gun rights. But there's got to be another side to this story, and nobody can tell it better than Chris Christie. So, Governor, I hope you will come on and tell us your story. And thank you, Steve, for calling.
Thank you.
And now we've got on the line a candidate who's going to be making a gubernatorial race. He's in the primary in Connecticut now against Governor Dan Malloy, in an effort to turn that very blue state back to freedom. Welcome, Tom Foley.
Good morning, Betsy. How are you?
Good. Now, we are eager to hear your story. What exactly will you do as governor to relieve the people of Connecticut from this extraordinary tax burden? Nobody wants to work till May 9th just to pay the tax collector.
Boy, we have so many things going wrong in Connecticut. We really need a rescue. But, you know, I ran in 2010. I came very close, within a half a percent, 6,400 votes. So Governor Malloy won by just a very narrow margin. And since he was elected, he's done a lot of things that have hurt the state. He had the largest tax increase in the state's history. He's done a lot of anti-business things, mandatory paid sick leave, and other things that have driven a lot of employers out of the state. So we've had Connecticut residents have fewer jobs now than they did when he was elected governor. So our jobs record is terrible, and we simply have to reverse that. I think I'm going to win in November, and we'll get it done.
And what exactly will you do? For example, what tax are you going to cut?
Well, first of all, we have to get spending under control. I'm going to hold spending flat for 2 years. Spending has gone up 4.5% a year under Governor Malloy, or about 15% or $2 billion while he's been governor. So we can solve our fiscal problems just by holding spending where it is. I'm going to take a half a percent off the sales tax. I'm going to take we're going to eliminate any tax or fee in Connecticut that costs more to collect than it generates in revenue. And the Yankee Institute up here estimates there may be over 200 of those taxes and fees. So we'll simply get rid of those. We'll eliminate the business entity tax for small businesses, so on and so forth. And then we're going to look, and I will work with the legislature on comprehensive tax reform, which Connecticut needs.
Well, I'm glad you said, you sound like a very smart guy, and the one of the first things you said is, well, the real problem is spending. Amen. That's true on the federal level, too, where we see the spending increase regardless of the taxes. The federal government does something states can't do, which is to get further and further in debt, get us all further and further in debt. On the spending side, what do you think you can hold down?
Well, all we have to do is just tell the government that they can't spend any more next year than they spent last year. We have this strange system here in Connecticut, which wouldn't work in the private sector business, where they ask all the commissioners and the departments of government, in order to provide the same services you provided last year, what would you have to spend next year? And they come up with a 7 or 8% increase. And then they cut 2% off of that, and they say they've cut, and yet spending is going up by 4, 5, 6% a year here in Connecticut.
That's what they do in the federal government too. It's called baseline budgeting. The increases are built in.
Budget. crazy, and the ordinary citizens don't understand it, so they're being deceived by governors like Governor Malloy.
How are you on Second Amendment rights?
I support the Second Amendment. Governor Malloy put in a very aggressive gun control law here. We had a terrible tragedy in Connecticut.
We know, Newtown, sure.
Yeah.
Terrible.
But I think that was a mental health case, and the bill that the governor passed had nothing to do with providing more mental health services to people who need it. So the people who believe in the Constitution of the United States and the Second Amendment are behind me.
Good. Glad to hear that. And tell us a little bit about school choice in Connecticut. That's an issue that matters to a lot of people.
Correct. Well, we don't have school choice in Connecticut. In one community, Hartford, we have in-district school choice. It's it's worked pretty well. And if I'm governor, I'm going to have comprehensive education reform. And one of the things we'll have is in districts where schools are not performing, we'll have in-district public school choice. We will expand the number of charter schools that are available. And we will have money following the child. Right now we have kind of a crazy system where there is choice, the money doesn't follow the child. So schools actually prefer to have students leave because they still get the stipend from the
That's
state
outrageous.
Government.
That's outrageous.
And yet their costs drop.
That's outrageous.
So the market isn't really working the way school choice is supposed to work, and let the marketplace work and let parents make decisions doesn't work here.
And what about extending it so that parents who want to send their children to religious schools can get a little help?
Yeah, that right now in Connecticut, that would be very, very difficult to achieve. But I think if we could get money follows the child and in-district public school choice and more charter schools, then maybe that would be a next step.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, when we talk about education, the hot-button issue now is Common Core.
Yeah. Well, what Governor Malloy did here, he had what I call education reform light. He did a few superficial things that really aren't going to solve the achievement gap in Connecticut. Believe it or not, Connecticut has the largest achievement gap in the nation.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the achievement gap is the difference in performance between children who are on the school lunch program, which means they're low income, versus the average in the state, or non-low income kids. And Connecticut, with all its resources, has the biggest achievement gap. So we have some very good schools, but the reason we have the large achievement gap is because in our cities, the schools simply aren't performing. And I tell people on the campaign trail, I say, you know, America's premise and promise is fairness and opportunity. And where we aren't providing young people a decent education, that's neither fair nor are we providing opportunity, because you simply can't get a job and support a family if you don't have a decent education.
You know, I so agree. This is such an important issue. I grew up in Connecticut and made my way in life because I got a scholarship to college, and my life would have been completely different had I not had the advantages of education.
And absolutely.
So we do want to make sure that the schools are working everywhere, and it's in the cities then, like Bridgeport, Hartford, that the schools are not working.
Absolutely. And what the governor should have done, and what I'll do as governor, is just focus on those schools and school districts where local control isn't working. Instead, he came up with a one-size-fits-all and mandated from the state that local communities, even if they have excellent public schools and are doing a good job, had to conform with his reforms. So
sounds like Obamacare for education, one size fits all,
right.
To the detriment
so
of everyone.
Common Core. And, you know, why burden schools and school districts and teachers, for example, with additional paperwork and everything else when they're really doing a good job for kids? We simply need to let the teachers do their job. You can't educate kids without teachers who are both on board with what they're doing and have the time available to work with kids. So I oppose what he did.
Now, tell me, Governor Perry from Texas is up north right now. He's in New York, and probably he's going to go over to New Jersey and try to woo as many companies as possible to move down to Texas. Are you worried he's going to come into Connecticut turf, too?
Well, I'm worried now because Governor Malloy has sent a very strong message to the business community that he's anti-business. And so business leaders right now might be able to be wooed by Governor Perry. But I think that a lot of them see that, you know, we had a Quinnipiac poll out a couple of weeks ago, and I was dead even with Governor Malloy, which for a Republican this far out in a blue state is unbelievable, and probably means we're going to win. So I think that the business leaders here, business people, will stick around until November at least to see whether or not we have new leadership and a new direction.
Well, freedom lovers all over the nation are watching this race in hopes that someone, you or another candidate, will take on Malloy and relieve Connecticut residents from this crushing tax burden, and also from being held hostage to the public employee union, something that's happening all around the country, and that gun rights will be restored. We all grieve for the families of Newtown, but taking people's Second Amendment rights away is not the way to solve that problem either. So thank you so much for joining us, Tom Foley. Do you want to give your website?
Yeah, it's TomFoleyCT.com. Anybody who's in Connecticut who wants to help out can contribute. The maximum is $100, which is a good deal. But any contribution is matched. $100 contribution is matched with $2,400. So we have a public financing program here that I'm qualifying for. So any help there would be really appreciated.
Well,
and anybody in Connecticut who votes, please get out and vote for me.
Thank you. It's great to talk to candidates because it takes a lot of guts to run for office, and you're doing it for the second time around. It's a huge hardship for yourself, for you, and for your family, and it's really an American thing to do. So congratulations.
Thank you very much, but I'd be honored to serve. We need good leadership, and certainly in Connecticut, we need a new direction, which I hope to be able to provide.
Well, and we all want to see more red states rising. I think that's the biggest phenomenon in the United States right now is the enormous success of red states where governors that are fossil fuel friendly and believe in low taxes and strong fiscal management, stand up to the public employees unions, are just attracting more and more population. People are not only voting, they're voting with their feet.
Yeah, and we have so few Republicans serving in New England. I would love to beat Governor Malloy, who's kind of the poster boy for the progressive agenda, and show that there's a path forward for Republicans in New England. I think we're going to see a big shift in this election, and I'm hoping very much to demonstrate what we can do.
Thank you again, Tom Foley. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. We're going to be taking a break. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction. And when we get back, we're going to be talking more about how to restore this nation to the vision of the framers. Individual freedom, freedom to earn a living and share it with your family instead of sending it to the tax collector. 855-40-LAURA. Join the debate.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham, the voice of liberty. Glad you're back with me. We're going to be talking with Ambassador John Bolton right after the break. But first, I have some Lone Star news to share with you. Texas, of course, is known as the Lone Star State, but frankly, I'd give it 5 stars because in every way, Governor Rick Perry of Texas seems to be leading the pack in how to manage a state. And he has challenged Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York State to a debate. It was a very polite challenge issued just yesterday, but I would like to see this debate. During the challenge, Perry reminded Governor Cuomo and all who were listening that CEO Magazine named New York 49th as a place to do business, 49th out of 50, almost dead last. Texas took the number one spot as the best place to do business, the number one spot for 9 years running. And in the headlines this morning, here's a really interesting story. Texas is expected to outproduce all but one of the OPEC nations this year. That's absolutely extraordinary. Texas, all by itself, is really making the major contribution to energy sufficiency in the United States. The Lone Star State is expected to end 2014 with 3.4 million barrels per day in oil output. That exceeds the output of 11 of the 12 OPEC nations. And you can contrast that, of course, to Governor Andrew Cuomo's opposition to fracking in New York State. New York could be contributing to the nation's energy self-sufficiency, but it is not. So we need to see this debate between Andrew Cuomo and Governor Rick Perry of Texas. It'll be fireworks for sure. And in terms of facts, it's Governor Perry who will be packing all the heat because he's got most of the facts on his side. And it would actually be interesting to bring Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey, in for a debate like this, too. As I said just a moment ago, he's very popular, very engaging, very likable, very believable. But it appears that he doesn't hold a candle to Governor Rick Perry's fiscal accomplishments in the 5-star Lone Star State. So it's good to look at the numbers And that's what we ought to be doing as we consider who should be the next president of this great nation. After the break, we'll be talking with Ambassador John Bolton about why defense spending should be increased, not cut, as the Obama administration is presently doing it, and why it appears that the United States, yes, is in another Cold War, despite what President Barack Obama said during the 2012 presidential debate. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham, at 855-40-LAURA. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. And we are very honored to have with us Ambassador John Bolton, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations and a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And let's get right with it, because Ambassador Bolton has so much important information to share with us. Welcome, Ambassador.
Glad to be with you, Betsy. Thanks for having me.
In the 2012 presidential debates, I bet everybody remembers when Obama zinged Romney for, quote, living in the past. He said the Cold War has been over for 20 years. Now, as we see Obama sending hundreds of U.S. troops into four nations in Eastern Europe for military exercises to, I suppose, deter Moscow from further aggression against the Ukraine, are we back in the Cold War?
Well, I don't think we're back in a Cold War in the ideological sense, but we're really back in an age of international power politics, which we really never left. And the Cold War, the World War II, were wars of ideology as well as power politics. But Obama has made the basic mistake of thinking that his inauguration brought a new era to the world, and it hasn't. And so, as you rightly say, after 5 years of pressing this famous reset button and getting absolutely nowhere, Obama announces to the House organ of the White House, the New York Times, that actually he's lost faith in Vladimir Putin and he'll basically ignore him for the next 3 years. Well, good luck with that.
Ignore him? I say that as a rhetorical question, because I think most Americans must be a little confused. At one point, John Kerry told Congress that broad sanctions against Russia's banking sector, energy sector, mining sector were on the table. But so far, what's happened to all these sanctions?
Well, the sanctions that have been put in place have been pinpricks. They've been insignificant. They've obviously not affected Russian behavior in the slightest. The president has told us again in Japan that new sanctions are teed up, in his phrase. But it doesn't, once again, the threat of sanctions are certainly not deterring Putin. Yesterday, Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov compared the situation in Ukraine to that of Georgia in the summer of 2008, which was right before Russia invaded Georgia. And today, Vladimir Putin described the killing of up to five people in eastern Ukraine by Ukrainian military forces as a great crime. I mean, speaking of being teed up, the Russians are now teed up for further military intervention in Ukraine, if that's what they've decided to do. And I don't think they're intimidated by the rhetoric coming from the Obama administration at all.
So do you expect that Putin will actually occupy and annex the Ukraine the way he did Crimea?
You know, I really don't think that's what he started out to do. When the Yanukovych government in Ukraine was overthrown, that was a huge setback to Putin and a real opportunity for the West, which we have systematically squandered. I think what Putin prefers is a government in Ukraine that's subordinate to his will. I always thought annexation was plan B, but I think he watched what happened in the case of the Crimea, where he got away at essentially no cost using military force to change the boundaries on the continent of Europe, And I think he has concluded again that he can do the same. Now, maybe Obama's got something up his sleeve, but it would be a departure from the way he's conducted foreign policy for the last 5 years if that were true.
So are you suggesting, I don't want to put words in your mouth, I'm just trying to understand for everybody, is it Obama's dithering that may be encouraging Putin to go toward that more radical step of annexation?
Oh, absolutely. You're not putting words in my mouth at all. I think Putin was so amazed by the weakness and fecklessness of the West's response to what happened in Crimea that he has concluded, in effect, to double down. And from the Russian point of view, I think the only thing that needs to happen now is for Putin to give the go-ahead order. I think the Russians are ready to go, and I think we've watched Obama play right into his hands.
What about the Baltics or Poland?
Well, you know, the Baltics are NATO members, and
right.
if Putin goes against them, it's a direct blow at the NATO alliance. I have to say, I'm worried that Putin may feel that Obama is so weak that he can not only reestablish Russian hegemony in the space of the former Soviet Union, he could drive a stake right into the heart of NATO itself. That would be something he never would have predicted 3 months ago. But that may wake even the Europeans up. Putin's got a lot of other fish to fry in the republics of the former Soviet Union before he goes after the Baltics. But that's why we've dispatched these troops as a political signal to the Baltics that we're going to stand with them. Well, let's face it, though, it's 600 men. That's all that it
yes,
is.
Yes, when I read that number, I thought, is that a typographical error?
You know,
it seems
it's a
so
political
small.
Signal.
Right.
Yeah, no, it's a political signal. I think it's the right thing to do, but nobody should believe this is a real concrete deterrent to Putin. I think we're in a real crisis situation here in terms of how the West deals with Russia, and it has global significance. Because China is watching Ukraine as carefully as anybody else in the world, given China's territorial ambitions in the East and South China Sea. And if we do not respond effectively, as we have not so far in Ukraine, that's going to tell China they've got a green light for their claims, too.
Am I correct in saying that we can't afford at any cost to allow NATO to be breached?
No, NATO is the most successful alliance in history. We always have difficulty with some of our NATO allies, but if that alliance goes down, the West as a whole is substantially weakened, and not just in Europe, but really around the world. So a lot rides on this, and we've got a president who I don't think understands the fundamental strategic reality that we're facing in Europe. I think Putin understands it all too well, and he's playing against a president he sees as weak, inattentive, and ineffective.
Well, now that brings us to a major question here at home, and that is defense spending, about which you wrote a very important article recently in the Washington Examiner. So if more money is needed for defense, as you argue, where should we put it?
Well, I think that we're in trouble all across the board on our defenses, conventional capabilities, naval capabilities, air capabilities, missile defense, which the Obama administration has all but given away, national missile defense to defend the territory of the United States. That's why the next president, whoever it is, has got a deep hole to dig out of. And I think Putin and other adversaries around the world see that, too. They see a declining American military. They see our capabilities under strain. And the next 3 years provide them an opportunity to take advantage of it. They don't know who will be elected in 2016. I don't think they're going to wait around to find out.
It takes a long time to rebuild a military, too, correct?
It does. Ronald Reagan showed how to do it in 1981 when he inherited a hollowed-out military from Jimmy Carter in the midst of the Cold War. But our economic circumstances now are worse than they were then. I think the task is much more difficult. We're talking about more sophisticated, more expensive weapon systems. There are going to be some tough decisions for a new president. If we get a new president who even believes we need a stronger defense budget, I don't think that's where Hillary Clinton is.
Oh, tell me more about that. I hadn't thought of asking you that question, but since you raise it, she did serve as Secretary of State, so we should have some evidence of her views on defense spending.
Well, you know, she was on the Senate Armed Services Committee, and a lot of people like to portray her as being stronger on national security than Obama. I think that's a dangerous misperception. I think her heart is exactly where Obama's is. Now, her political spin doctors may be able to change the impression, but I think her priority is with the same as Obama's. Health care reform, Hillary care, and Obamacare are fundamentally indistinguishable, and I think her presidency will be fundamentally indistinguishable from Obama's. 16 years of that, and we are in deep trouble.
Well, not only are we in deep trouble, but as you just suggested, the NATO countries are in deep trouble. Parts of the Far East are in deep trouble. Among our Eastern allies, who is most threatened?
In Eastern Europe or East Asia?
No, East Asia.
Well, I think Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan all see what a rising China can do to them, what these claims in the South China Sea would do. You know, all of the oil from the Middle East that goes to South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan goes through the South China Sea. And if China is able to make good on its claims in that area, they could turn what are now international waters into, in effect, a Chinese lake. They'd have their hands around the throat of the energy supply to Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. This is a huge change in circumstances. I think Japan and the others will resist, but they need help from the United States. And despite the president's rhetoric in Japan yesterday, which was all to the good, that's not backed up by concrete assets. And I think that's what we really are looking at.
One final question, and we so appreciate your wisdom. Obama is going to nominate a Cold War veteran, John Taft, as ambassador to Russia. What signal does that give us? What signal does that give Putin? He worked under George W. Bush, didn't he, as ambassador to Georgia and Lithuania?
Well, yeah, he's a career foreign service officer. He knows the area well. I think he'll do the best job he can under the circumstances. But it's also a signal to Russia that Obama just doesn't think it's that important. If he thought it were more important, he'd put a significant political figure in that job, and he's not doing it. So if I were Putin, I would read this as yet another indication that Obama's just tired of having to deal with the Russian problem. He wants to consign it to a more bureaucratic channel so he can get on with something else. I think, unfortunately, it's no reflection on Taft at all. It's a reflection, again, another piece of evidence that Obama just doesn't give national security a high priority.
Well, thank you very much, Ambassador Bolton. Once again, you've given us not only your valuable time, but your invaluable insights. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Betsy. Good luck.
It's very interesting to hear the ambassador talk about the president's dithering. There was a piece in the New York Post yesterday calling Obama our President Pinocchio. Not because of what he said about health care, you can keep your plan if you like it, but because of the broken threats, the broken promises, the unfulfilled statements he's made to foreign leaders. More on that after the break. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction. Give us a call, 855-40-LAURA.
The Laura Ingraham Show. Call Laura now, 1-855-40-LAURA.
This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. Just before the break, we were speaking with Ambassador John Bolton, former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., about the dangers in the world, dangers not incited by, but certainly made more dangerous by, President Obama's dithering, his saying one thing but really meaning something else or not meaning anything close to what his words connoted. We are facing the same dangers at home because of the president's unwilling to deal honestly with the American people. I'm looking here at a Fox News poll that found that 61% of Americans believe that the president lies frequently or habitually. Only 15% of Americans polled said the president never tells a lie. Not like George Washington. This is a real threat to the functioning of American government. When Americans can't believe what their president is telling them, for example, if you like your health plan, you can keep your health plan, a fundamental promise behind the enactment of the Affordable Care Act. But even beyond the lying is the seizing of power not allocated to the presidential branch of government under the U.S. Constitution. The grabbing for power that rightly belongs in the legislative branch of government. And I promised at the beginning of the program that we would consult some of the real experts on this. And I went back and looked at what George Washington advised about this. When Washington was leaving after serving two terms as the nation's first president, he had some very sober advice for the nation. He explained that there may come a time in the future when the nation believes that the U.S. Constitution does not afford the president sufficient authority. After all, it was an experiment writing this Constitution. Maybe the framers got it a little wrong, and that at some time in the future they would need a stronger president. But he said, do not allow the president to usurp that power with promises that he will use that extra constitutional authority for good deeds. Always make sure that the people whose authority is behind the law agree to that increase in power. Here's what he wrote. Quote, if there comes a time that the people agree the president should have more power, let that charge be made legitimately by amending the Constitution, rather than by allowing the president to take it. Let there be no change by usurpation, he wrote, for though this in one instance may be the instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. That, folks, is what you are seeing happen right now. The president usurping authority, claiming he is doing it for the good of the nation, releasing felons when Congress has not changed the sentencing guidelines, ignoring the immigration laws for the good of the nation, imposing environmental regulations not approved by Congress for the good of the nation, altering his own Obamacare health law for the good of the nation. This is how representative self-government is lost and despotisms are created. So be aware, our framers 200 years ago, 225 years ago this month, anticipated this and warned us about it. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction. After the break, Louis Gohmert, Congressman from Texas. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the Voice of Liberty, Laura Ingraham. Thank you for standing by with us. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Congressman Louis Gohmert of Texas, who's a member of the House Judiciary Committee. That committee is deeply involved in trying to rein in our lawless president, seeking ways to discipline him now that in general, Congress has lacked the stomach to use the power of the purse and deny the executive branch funding. So the House Judiciary Committee is actually seeking ways to sue the president because he has so frequently violated the Constitution. And I have right here on my desk a brand new report issued by the House Judiciary Committee and the Majority Whip Eric Cantor called The Imperial Presidency, an Update. It's literally a 66-page list of all the president's violations of the Constitution. Most of them involve the president's overreach. In other words, seeking to change laws or make laws without the legislative branch. And if you think this is just nitpicking, it really isn't, because when the president willfully and unpredictably changes the laws or imposes new, quote, regulations that he lacks the authority to impose, it has a terrible impact on your job security and your income, your ability to make a living. Because when laws are created out of the executive branch, when laws are selectively executed, when the administration intervenes and constantly changes what the law is, businesses can't make decisions. Investors don't invest. Employers stop hiring. And you see a lot of that happening right now. One of the reasons our economy has slowed down, can't quite get that oomph to recover from the recession, is that the president has taken away something that is vital to the success of an economy, the rule of law. For 225 years, we've taken for granted the fact that laws only change when our elected representatives seek to change them. But now we have the unpredictability of rule by an almost dictator. And this is a problem that I have asked Congressman Louie Gohmert to address. He's on the line with us now. We're delighted to have him. Congressman Louie Gohmert from Texas, a member of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee, welcome.
Well, it's good to talk to you again, Betty.
Thanks for calling. One of the things...
All right, sure, Betty.
That's okay. One of the things I... you can call me Betty anytime.
Sorry. No, Betty. I know better. Thanks, Betty.
Yesterday, the president and Eric Holder made an announcement that they are going to release countless numbers, they didn't tell us how many, of drug dealers and drug offenders, in effect retroactively changing federal sentencing laws. It's not like granting amnesty or clemency to one or two people. These are whole categories of felons. What's your response to that?
Well, when you take it in conjunction to the fact that so many Democrats have been pushing for felons to be allowed to vote, it does make for an interesting election season move. But
why don't they just hand out the ballots, slip them under the cell doors?
Well, but you're talking to a guy who has been a judge and a chief justice, but I saw the folly in federal laws that needed to be changed, knew that if our system was going to survive, that judges, others who are not legislators, should not be legislating. So I did not run again. I ran for Congress so that I could participate in the legislative process constitutionally. But we have an administration that could care less about the Constitution and, you know, the balance of powers. They keep usurping congressional authority. And one of the biggest tragedies ever is that you have a Senate, and a Senate majority, and Democrats in the House that would stand up and applaud a president who announces, if Congress doesn't do their job, I'm going to do it for them. My gracious, that is such an outrage. And they
I saw that, Congressman.
Applaud.
I saw that at the State of the Union address, and it took my breath away, too.
Unbelievable. I was just so shocked. They become such drones that they just fly wherever they're directed and applaud whenever their Fuhrer says, I'm going to do your job for you. That's not how the Constitution works. We have a president, and I've been told by people, legislators or Congress members from the 70s, 80s, 90s, that, you know, when a president started taking over congressional power, whether it was Republican or Democrat, there'd be a quiet visit, didn't make the news, from Republican and Democrat leaders in the House and Senate that said, knock it off or we're going to start cutting everything you care about. And that took care of things. But now we have enablers in the majority in the Senate who are just allowing the Constitution to be eviscerated.
It's really tragic. I agree with you. We've been watching it and chronicling it on this show. Let me ask you something. The president said there wasn't a smidgen of corruption at the IRS, just a few boneheads, he told Bill O'Reilly. But newly released emails show an exchange of emails between the IRS and the Department of Justice that would suggest a high-level conspiracy to harm conservatives, to harass them. What does the House Judiciary Committee think should be done about that?
Well, I know that the people I talked to on the Judiciary Committee understand how outrageous that is and that we need to take action. The trouble is the head of the Department of Justice is, as we now speak, in contempt of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
He could care less about what Congress says. And he did threaten me, warn me that I don't want to go there, that he really did think it was a big deal. But we know for certain that it was not a big deal to him back closer to the time. He didn't see it as he didn't have any problem with it back then. He didn't respect Congress. He didn't care about what they did. So he can bluster all he wants at a hearing toward me, but the man's dishonest. He is usurping power himself.
Now, what can you do about it? When he is in contempt of Congress, what powers does the House have to punish him?
Well, I was really bothered that someone in contempt of Congress would come floating into the House chamber during the State of the Union address and be so cavalier as he stood there and giving every appearance that, just as I said, he really didn't care so much that he was in contempt. And I'd ask former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, you had one of the best rules guys helping you there's ever been. Was there something we could have done? He said, yeah, you could pass a resolution in the House that directed the House Sergeant at Arms to detain anyone who was in contempt of Congress and that was there at the Capitol complex until such time as the reason for their contempt were eliminated, were purged. In other words, if you're in contempt for not producing information, then you produce the information and you get released. And that's the way contempt works in the judiciary. You know, there have been people I'd find in contempt and you send them to jail. And so it was a different experience for me questioning somebody that was in contempt. Normally as a judge, I didn't do that. You went to jail and when you were ready to produce, the information, then we brought you back.
So do you have the power to put Eric Holder in jail?
We have the power to direct the Sergeant of Arms to detain him. And there is, I'm told there's a cell somewhere on Capitol Hill where they can detain people. And if we ordered the Sergeant of Arms to do that, then he is supposed to do that.
Do you think it'll come to that?
I don't think we have the leadership that would be willing to ever do that. We didn't even vote to hold him in contempt until our leadership knew that what would happen if we held him in contempt is that it would go to the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia. He's not interested in following the law if it hurts his boss, Eric Holder. And so, nothing ended up happening.
I have this report in front of me. I was sharing it with our listeners before you came on, Congressman, the Imperial Presidency, an update. It's a very disheartening list of all the ways the president has ignored and violated the Constitution, from the recess appointments to the constant changes to Obamacare to the imposition of EPA standards to the war on coal, you name it. It just goes on and on. It's destroying our economy. My question to you is, you and the other House committee Judiciary Committee members. Do you ever talk about the I word? Do you ever actually go to discuss the ultimate remedy, impeachment?
Yes, that's an especially for somebody that's been in contempt for as long as this attorney general is. The problem is, when you undertake the I word for any administration official, then it sucks out all the air. You really don't get anything else accomplished. And there are a lot of things we need to be doing to address other usurpations of power, trying to fix some of them. But then when you know that that would suck all the air out of anything you try to do, and you send it to the Senate, and, you know, these guys, they're not going to ever allow anyone in this administration to ever be removed from office, then you wonder, okay, well, maybe that's not worth the time.
Right.
When we can be passing things that have more of a shot and bring America's attention more to the fact that the Senate is the one that shut down the government, despite the non-realization of that by our speaker. And the Senate is the one that continues to refuse to take action to make us energy independent. They refuse to take action to get America healthy and going and people back to work. So they need to be thrown out, those that are being so obstructionist.
Well, unfortunately, we have to conclude this conversation, but that's a terrific note on which to do it. The midterm elections, and let's hope that freedom-loving people can retake the United States Senate in this midterm election and then rein in a lawless president. Thank you so much, Congressman Gohmert, for joining us.
Thank
you for your service.
Thank you very much. Right. Thank you.
This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, standing in for Laura Ingraham, the voice of liberty. This is your healthy radio addiction.
Yeah, I'm a hail man, 100% Texan till I die.
The Laura Ingraham Show. Call the Laura Ingraham Show, 1-855-40-LAURA.
Welcome back, Bubala. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare 2014, and I'm standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. Join the debate. You can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. Here's something that you've probably heard before, but it's wisdom never expires. All that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. Edmund Burke issued that warning over two centuries ago, but it's never been more important than it is right now. And what can good people do, good people who are busy earning a living, taking care of their families? They can vote in November, because this midterm election is going to be critical. We, the lovers of freedom, need to retake the United States Senate. Why? Well, there are many specific policy issues involved, from Obamacare to environmental regulation, welfare reform, taxes. But the biggest reason is the one that I just discussed with Louis Gohmert, defense of the rule of law. No one wants to put this nation through the ordeal of impeachment, the I word, as Louis Gohmert said. But we need a Senate majority leader who will take a walk down Pennsylvania Avenue and have a quiet chat with the president about what he needs to do to respect the Constitution in order to avert a calamity of that nature. That's what's been done in the past. Legislative leaders meeting behind closed doors with presidents who have exceeded their powers and warning that president not to do it again. And we see a president now, President Obama, who is grabbing far more power than the Constitution allows. The president sidesteps Congress to make whatever laws he wants, whether there's support in Congress for it or not, whether it's releasing felons, as we discussed this morning, constantly changing his own namesake health law, Obamacare, or here are some that you haven't heard so much about. the draconian regulation of coal, which is putting thousands of people out of business in some parts of this country. The attempt to tell a private business, Boeing, where it can locate. The rule by waivers, handing waivers out to certain companies and certain unions, exempting from them from laws that the rest of us must obey. A very lengthy report was just issued by the House of Representatives chronicling this exhaustive, this very long and exhausting, I should say, list of violations of the Constitution. When we get back, we'll be focusing on the environment, and we'll be talking with a very brave scientist willing to stand up to the prophets of global warming as a religion. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
I really can't stay.
This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. You can reach us at Ingraham Angle. You can call us at 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. When I got home last night, there were so many emails and Facebook posts asking me to give you an update on Obamacare that I thought I would take one segment and just explain what's coming next. And unfortunately, it's not a lot of good news. But before I even get to the specifics, I saw a very interesting piece up on the Wall Street Journal online by James Taranto, one of the smartest people in journalism. And he was highlighting the weasel words used by Jean Shaheen, the governor of New Hampshire. She's been responding to inquiries about Obamacare because she supported Obamacare from the beginning and still strongly supports it. And she, whenever she's asked a question from someone who's lost their health plan or lost their doctor, which is happening a lot in New Hampshire, she responds by saying, quote, there's a lot of misinformation out there. A lot of misinformation out there is what she says. Well, there is a lot of misinformation out there. Unfortunately, it's not too much solace for the people of New Hampshire who have lost their ability to use 10 out of 26 hospitals in the state. What I keep hearing from people in New Hampshire is now that they're on an Obamacare plan, they're forced to drive by the local hospital where they used to take their children, where they used to go for care, and drive maybe an hour to another hospital. It's a shame. But here's what's ahead. And as I said, it's not good news, but it's better to be prepared. The first, big premium hikes ahead. Now, you may ask me, how can that be true? The Congressional Budget Office just said last week that premium hikes will be very, very small this year. Well, the CBO is cooking the books. If you actually talk to the insurance company executives, they will tell you that they anticipate double or even triple digit premium hikes ahead. So how can it be that the CBO says one thing and the insurance executives who are actually setting the rates are saying something else? Well, if you look at the fine print in the Congressional Budget Office report on page 4, I'm snickering and smiling as I say this, on page 4, the CBO authors say that they're basing their projections on no information. They have not looked at who signed up for Obamacare, so they're basing their projections on zero information. Well, that's not a good way to project anything, although the CBO seems to be doing it a lot lately. On the other hand, the insurance companies are looking at what's happening to Obamacare, the constant changes in the rules and the bailouts and et cetera. And they're saying, we expect very high premium hikes. So get ready for even costlier premiums in the year ahead. In addition, how about this one? This is going to be very problematic. Premium defaults. That is, a sizable number of people who have signed up for these plans, maybe as many as a million, will stop paying shortly. And why is that? Well, because they got bamboozled into signing up to begin with, and they didn't realize in many cases what a $3,000 or $5,000 deductible actually means. It means that they're going to be going to the doctor again and again and paying full freight, right? Because they have to spend their own money till they get to that $3,000 or $5,000 deductible, except for certain kinds of preventive care. So the fact is, they're going to be out of pocket a lot of money. And people who are living paycheck to paycheck and find that they have to pay full freight every time they go to the doctor are going to say, well, why am I also writing this check every month for a premium? They're going to stop writing that check and make a car payment instead. So you're going to see premium defaults ahead. In fact, the American Medical Association is so panicked about this, and remember, the AMA supported Obamacare from the beginning. The AMA is now so panicked about these defaults, and here's the reason. The law actually gives the consumers a 90-day grace period. They can default or fail to pay their premium for 90 days before their insurance is canceled. But the insurance company, according to the law, only has to pay the bill for the first 30 days. After that, it's the doctors and hospitals that are out the money. So doctors are saying, how can we afford to take this risk? We're already living, I mean, some doctors are having a hard time keeping their offices open. So the AMA is very panicked about this. They understand how many premium defaults there will be. Of course, for the Joan Q. public, perhaps the biggest problem ahead is losing your on-the-job coverage. And somewhere between 25 and 30 million people are likely to lose their on-the-job coverage in the months ahead. That is before the end of the year. And the reason is this. Employers who go out and buy a plan in the small group market, as many employers do, especially the smaller ones, they're going to find that when their current plan expires, they're not able to renew it. And they're going to have to go to the far more costly Obamacare plans. In other words, plans that include an essential benefit package that Washington knows best says must be included. Well, it's so much more costly than what they're currently offering that many employers are going to say, we can't offer that. So we're just going to drop coverage altogether and send our employees and their families to the Obamacare exchanges. And that's what's going to happen to somewhere between 25 and 30 million people, in all likelihood, in the months ahead. And be prepared if you're one of them, because having to sign up for Obamacare on an exchange is a raw deal compared with getting on-the-job coverage. You're going to have a much higher deductible, and you're going to have to pay your share with after-tax dollars. And for all of that, you'll probably find out that you can't stay with the doctors and hospitals you currently use. So I hate to be the bearer of bad tidings, but that's what's ahead for many, many people, millions of people who currently get on-the-job coverage from employers who buy in the small job market rather than self-insuring. So you might want to ask your own human resources department or your own employer whether you're going to be in that situation. And then finally, the worst news, sadly, is for people with cancer. Because most of these Obamacare plans carve out, exclude specialized cancer hospitals. And we're already beginning to hear terrible stories about cancer patients who have had to sign up for Obamacare. They lost their original plan or it got canceled because it no longer complied with the law. And now they've had to sign up for Obamacare, and suddenly they cannot use the doctors and hospitals they rely on. They may be in the middle of a chemotherapy treatment and have to change hospitals and change doctors. And unfortunately, most Obamacare plans do not cover treatment at places like Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. So you may get stuck going to a local hospital that's has very good caregivers, but does not have the specialty care you need. Research shows, for example, that women with ovarian cancer, on average, live a year longer when they're treated at a high-volume specialized cancer hospital rather than at a local community hospital. Same is also true for lung cancer surgery patients. So cancer patients, beware. Be on the alert that if you need care, you're going to have to investigate how to get that care without accessing the specialty cancer hospitals you assumed you could go to. And be aware of the weasel words from politicians like Jean Shaheen, who says there's a lot of misinformation out there. Most of the misinformation, unfortunately, is coming from the White House. And as the polls show, Americans have caught on. They know that they're not getting the truth about Obamacare. And that goes, of course, not only for the president, but from what his Congressional Budget Office is saying, and even in the future, what the Census Bureau is going to say. This was a development that really shocked me. The Census Bureau announced recently that they're going to ask questions differently when they investigate how many people are uninsured. Can you imagine changing the question in midstream just when we use census data to assess how much progress we're making in covering the uninsured? Now the question is going to be different, so the comparisons don't apply. We have Kim on the line from Oklahoma. Kim, what's on your mind?
I think that insurance companies are becoming greedy. I believe that they are making it where healthcare is going to be something like car insurance, where everyone has to have it. I am someone who doesn't believe in the Obamacare. I don't think that we should have it. I am someone who does not have insurance, and I don't want his insurance, and I'll accept all the penalties that come with not getting on his plan. So I am one who opposes the...
Well, I sympathize with you. And let me say there's only one word I question in everything you said. When you said becoming greedy, what do you mean becoming greedy? One of the worst...
I have to say...
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. I have to say I've lived in my house for almost 13 years here. And my house insurance went from $500 to $700. And I have not used my house insurance at all in all the 13 years that I've been there. Now, I think that like vehicle insurance, everybody has to have it. So there, it's against the law not to have even just liability.
Well, you know,
so
something. You're putting your finger on something very, very important. How dare the United States government force us to have all these different kinds of insurance? And worse still is that the Obamacare law actually provides bailouts for the insurance company to make their plans look more affordable than they actually are. We're paying a premium, and then we're also paying as taxpayers. I hate to cut you off, Kim, because I really think you're onto something so important here. Thank you for calling.
All right, thank you.
And this is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction. And when we get back, we're going to expose the fallacies and misconceptions and out-and-out lies behind some of the global warming claims. We are going to be talking with James Taylor from the Heartland Institute. So stand by. This is Betsy McCoy, your healthy radio addiction.
The Laura Ingraham Show. Call the Laura Ingraham Show, 1-855-40-LAURA.
Welcome back, Bubba. It's Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. Give us a call, 855-40-LAURA. I was just talking with Kim from Oklahoma about premiums. And, of course, premiums are going to shoot up, according to the health insurance executives. But what will keep them from going even higher isn't good news. Because the fact is, your pocket is getting picked at the other end. Yes, in the Affordable Care Act is a section 1342 that's designed to make insurance look affordable even when it isn't. What this section says is, it tells insurers, okay, price the plans lower than you really need to, because if you don't make money, we're going to bail you out at the other end using taxpayer dollars. How about that for a trick, right? We've got Patricia from California on the line. Welcome, Patricia.
Hi, Betsy. This is, you estimated that as many as 30 million people were going to be thrown off their employers' plans next.
That's
what
right.
I'd like to know is how many of those people are going to be thrown off before the 2014 election and how many before the 2016 election?
Well, I wish I could tell you exactly, but I would have to be inside the brain of each employer who makes a decision about whether he or she can afford the extra cost of offering the mandated Obamacare package when the current plan expires. So I can't tell you. I'm looking at how many people are employed and get coverage from an employer who buys in the small group market. And that's...
But didn't President Obama try to, didn't he deliberately, extrajudicially, extralegally put this off to try to avoid having it happen before the 2014 and the 2016 elections?
Well, what he really did, I like those words extrajudicially and illegally because you're right on both those points, but he didn't actually postpone the employer mandate. All he did was say employers who currently don't offer insurance won't have to offer it until after the election, but employers who do currently offer it will have to continue to offer it. And that's the trap, because the employers who currently offer it, their plans are going to expire, but they're going to be legally required to continue to offer insurance. And that's the group I'm talking about.
Thank you.
So that's the fine print. You didn't hear from the White House, but it is in the regulation. I thank you so much for calling, Patricia, and I hope it doesn't happen to you.
No, thank you. Thank you.
You're quite welcome. So just to wrap up, this insurance company bailout is really a trickster bailout. And to make things worse, just a few weeks ago on a Friday afternoon, the Obama administration slipped out a regulatory change to make the bailout more generous as a way of offsetting the inevitably higher premium hikes that are coming down the pike before the election, which won't be so good for the president's allies. So it's all coming out of your pocket, John Q. Public, good, steady, dependable taxpayer, and that's the bad news. After the break, we'll have some good news, however, from James Taylor from the Heartland Institute, who's going to assure us that, in fact, our air is getting better, our water is getting cleaner, and the global alarmists, well, maybe they've got a problem all their own. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for the Voice of Liberty, Laura Ingraham. Betsy McCoy, author of Beating Obamacare 2014 and former Lieutenant Governor of New York State. Call me with your Obamacare questions. I get a lot of them on Facebook and email, but it's really fun to hear from you in person and discuss them on the air because everybody has the same questions. Don't think there's anything about your question that everybody else doesn't want to hear. So I'm here to answer those questions. And when we get back, James Taylor from the Heartland Institute. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction.
Laura now, 1-855-40-LAURA.
This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the Voice of Liberty, Laura Ingraham. And we're going to be talking about heat waves right now. We have a very special guest, James Taylor, who is an environmental specialist at the Heartland Institute. And he's one of those brave souls who is standing up against what some people in white coats called settled science. I've never heard of such a preposterous term, settled science. Science, by definition, means ongoing inquiry, questioning what everybody else believes is true. So congratulations, James, for doing that. And we'd like to hear more about whether the Earth is or is not heating up. There's no debate about the fact that the controversy about global warming is heating up.
Right. Well, whenever you hear the term settled science, I think we should keep in mind that 98% of the computer models that are cited by the global warming activists agree it's settled science that our real-world temperature observations must be wrong, because 98% of the models predicted far too much warming and cannot replicate real-world conditions. So I don't know how you describe settled science, but it's certainly not pairing up real-world observations with previous assertions and predictions.
Yeah, from what I've seen and from what I've read, it appears that the Earth stopped warming about 17 years ago. It was part of a fluctuation. So is global warming going the way of global cooling, which we worried about 40 years ago, overpopulation, pesticide residues, West Nile virus, bird flu, cell phone radiation, mad cow disease? Is global warming going to bite the dust next?
Well, global warming should never have been this asserted crisis in the first place. It is true that temperatures have warmed during the past century, and that's a good thing. Humans did not fare very well during the Little Ice Age. We had far more famines, plagues, droughts, extreme weather events during those cooler temperatures. So when we have environmental activists say that we're facing the hottest decade in history, what they define as history is merely the past 100 or so years since the Little Ice Age ended. Will we see more warming in the future? I think it's probable, because we're adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and that, all other things being equal, will warm the atmosphere. But the thing is, and here's the key point, what the carbon dioxide is doing is adding a little bit of warming, not a ton of warming, and the warming that we have had has been beneficial to human health and welfare, and will likely be so, will be beneficial for many decades, if not centuries, to come.
Especially for people who live in northern climes like Canada. Let me ask you, for our listeners, to put this in perspective. I remember reading some fascinating reports by one of your scientific colleagues, Sally Balunas, giving a very long-term perspective from the Middle Ages on about the fluctuations in global temperatures.
Right, and that's really the most important point. There are several key points that the global warming activists refuse to acknowledge or bring up, but probably the most important one is long-term context. As I mentioned, the global warming activists will talk about the hottest years on record, but that's because they define, quote, on record as merely the past 100 years or so. If we look back over the past 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 years, we see that today's temperatures are actually quite cool compared to the long-term average. And this is a period when human civilization developed and thrived. It's important to keep in mind that we can keep warming at our present pace, and we will still be cooler than temperatures have been over the past several thousand years. We'll still be cooler than that for many decades, if not centuries, to come.
And aside from temperatures, there are other things we can measure. I've noticed that lately the alarmists have changed their nomenclature from global warming to climate change. I found that very curious. It's like talking about children growing as if there's something alarming about change. But when Hurricane Sandy hit, it became the poster child for climate change and the dangers of climate change. Yet, tell us about the number of hurricanes in recent history and the number of tornadoes in recent history.
Right. And the change in the terminology from global warming to climate change reveals just how anti-science their efforts are, because we know that the Earth's climate has always been changing. And when they say that we need to stop climate change, it's something that cannot be done and has never been done before. What they're hoping to do is convince the American people that any time there's any type of climate change, any warming or cooling in temperatures, that it's unprecedented and must be caused by humans, when it's quite false. But regarding hurricanes, tornadoes, and other asserted extreme weather events, we know it's indisputable from National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration data that the number of hurricanes is in long-term decline. The number of tornadoes is in long-term decline.
And
droughts
severity of them, too,
decline.
Right? Not only the numbers, but also the severity of these weather events.
Right, especially the severity. When you look at tornadoes, the F3 to F5 tornadoes, the strongest ones, they're the ones showing the strongest decrease. And when you look at hurricanes and the hurricane strikes in the United States, we're currently undergoing the longest period in recorded United States history without a Category 3 or higher hurricane striking the United States. But they think that if they say over and over again, if they say it frequently enough, that global warming causes extreme weather events, people will believe it, despite the objective data showing just the opposite. And we have to keep in mind that the United States is a large place. The world is a large place. There's always going to be a tornado striking somewhere, or a hurricane striking somewhere, or a drought occurring somewhere. And the global warming activists will point out to each of these events and lead you to believe that it must be caused by humans. But the actual facts, the objective data, show that we're seeing a decrease in the number and severity of all these extreme weather events. So it would be quite a trick if global warming caused the very few that still remain.
That's really the most important point, isn't it? That, in fact, weather severity is not a problem right now.
Absolutely. And every time that someone points out the number of deaths from a particular hurricane or from a particular tornado or a drought or a flood, multiply that by, you know, double that and say that's the number of deaths that have been prevented by global warming. Now, when I say double, I'm throwing a number out there. But the fact of the matter is there has been a decline in the frequency and severity of these extreme weather events. So all those human misery stories are becoming less frequent as the planet warms. That's a good thing. Unfortunately, some people think that anything that humans do that in any way affects the, quote, natural environment must be bad. But that's not the case.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up. You make me feel a little better because when we celebrated Earth Day earlier this week, I was celebrating fossil fuels. Look at the things that Earth gives us, coal, oil, shale. And we, with our human ingenuity, can take those basic resources, which have been around since before the caveman, and turn them into neon lights on Times Square and all the things that make our living so comfortable, all the labor-saving devices, all the medical technology, all run with these basic fossil fuels. So let me ask you this. There's also a lot of focus on the Arctic Circle and the Antarctic and the melting of the ice and the fate of the polar bears. Give us your insights on that.
Yeah, we hear a lot in the media, not so much anymore, but we still hear it. We heard it quite a bit a few years ago about the asserted Arctic ice cap melting and the polar ice caps receding. But what we know is that, sure, in 2007, there was basically you had Arctic wind patterns that were quite unusual. And instead of blowing the Arctic ice up against the land masses of North America and Asia, where the ice would be trapped and accumulate, instead the wind shifted that year and blew the ice south through the strait near Greenland into the North Atlantic. So you had a decline in Arctic sea ice. But that was a one-time event. You haven't seen any further decline. At the same time, in the southern hemisphere, in Antarctica, the sea ice has been growing for as long as we've been measuring it, since 1979 when satellites were launched. And, in fact, we see that this year we've set a number of records for sea ice extent in Antarctica. And the most important point is when you look at the two combined, after all, we're talking about global warming and global climate change. Global sea ice for the past year plus has been above the long-term average. So any assertion that we're facing this unmitigated, unrelenting decline in polar ice is ridiculous. Some years it's lower than average, some years it's higher than average, and if you're looking for a trend, for more than a year now, we've been above average for the extent of polar sea ice. And when I say sea ice, if you look at land ice, it's the same thing. Basically, the land ice doesn't change in Antarctica. Mm-hmm. So the polar ice caps are actually higher than normal, and yet the alarmists will tell us that it's lower than average because they hope that people won't check the facts.
Now, there was a big story in the press this morning about a very large iceberg, six times the size of Manhattan Island in New York, that broke off from part of Antarctica and is floating. Any cause to worry about that?
Yeah, this is wonderful because every few years we see media reports about a particular ice shelf or ice sheet cracking at a certain juncture and putting a large piece of ice in the ocean. And the implicit argument is that this must be caused by global warming and shows that we're having receding polar ice. But the fact of the matter is, as ice grows each year, and as it grows really each winter within each year, at some point you're going to have that ice be unsustainable if it's floating above the ocean, and it's going to break off and form icebergs. Icebergs are not a new phenomenon since global warming has occurred. It's not a new phenomenon over the past couple decades. Mm-hmm. But what's important to keep in mind, look at the global ice extent, and when you see that that has increased rather than decreased around the poles, you can't blame a particular iceberg cracking off in Antarctica on global warming. Antarctic ice extent is greater now than it's been since we've been measuring it for the past 30-plus years.
Boy, that is a really important point to underscore, that the ice extent is bigger than at any time since you've been measuring it. Now, just to turn to politics for a minute, James, less than a week after the invasion of the Ukraine, John Kerry, Secretary of State, blasted scientists in the United States and elsewhere who disagree with the president's emphasis on global warming, literally accusing them of being more dangerous to the globe than terrorists or the Russian invaders. What are your thoughts on this? How do you respond to the president who's labeling you an enemy to the country?
Well, it's always in poor taste, if not outright dangerous,
well done.
for American officials to go abroad and then criticize Americans. Now, in this case, what we had is John Kerry, during the Ukrainian crisis, as Russian troops were pouring into the Ukraine, making a point as his high-profile talk of the day and of the week to blast global warming skeptics as, quote, flat earthers, et cetera. Now, if you're Vladimir Putin and you see that the American Secretary of State during such a crisis is doing little more than paying lip service to what's going on in the Ukraine and instead focusing his attention and choosing, making a deliberate decision to focus the world's attention on global warming skeptics rather than what's going on in the Ukraine, this is not going to be something that's going to deter Putin from further aggression, nor will it deter other tyrants or aggressive dictators from future aggression. And it just goes to show where the priorities of this administration are, and that's dangerous.
Well stated. This has really been so illuminating. So how would you, what would you do to better inform Congress about the fallacies behind some of the policies that are being so hotly, to coin a phrase, pursued by the administration?
Well, not just Congress, but the American people can access a report by the Non-Governmental International Panel on Climate Change. These are scientists from around the world that have compiled the latest and best science on global warming.
You know what? I'll put it up on my website for you.
Fantastic. More than 1,000 peer-reviewed studies are cited showing, explaining why humans are not creating a global warming crisis. And I believe that the human people, armed with the truth, that they're smart enough to make sure that government is not going to run the opposite direction and sink our ship. And I'm optimistic that ultimately we'll prevail. Truth will prevail on this issue.
Well, as usual in science, truth does prevail, but it also takes courageous individuals like you. I'm very grateful for what you're doing. And I will put that report up on the BetsyMcCoy.com website as soon as James sends it to me so that there's another place you can access it. And you can also go to the Heartland Institute and see his very important work. Thank you so much, James.
Thank you very much. Anytime.
So this is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State and author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingram. This is your healthy radio addiction.
The Laura Ingram Show. Call Laura now, 1-855-40-LAURA.
This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State and author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for Laura Ingram, the voice of liberty. This is our closing segment. I want to thank you for spending this time with me. I will be back tomorrow. And tomorrow we have a fantastic lineup. KT McFarland will be discussing whether President Obama's dithering is actually inviting an attack on NATO. Then we're going to be talking with a politician who was trying to topple Andrew Cuomo, governor of New York State, certainly the state where taxes are among the highest in the nation. We've got an invitation out to Governor Rick Perry of Texas. He may come by, too. And we're going to be talking with Wall Street expert David Malpass about money, your money and my money. But this is the Freedom Show. That's the point. This is the Freedom Show, and freedom includes the freedom for all of us to keep the fruits of our labor and to enjoy it with our families. Right now, total government spending has reached 42% of GDP. That means that all of us going out to work every day, all of the fruits of our labor, government is sucking up 42% of it, right? I know you don't get 42% of your happiness from government. I certainly don't. So it's time for some spring cleaning. President Obama promised that he would get rid of all the waste in government, but it hasn't happened. It's up to us. And this fall, when we go to the polls, we have to elect people who are committed to freedom, smaller government, lower taxes, more liberty for the people of the United States, and less money in the pockets of the Washington spendaholics. They are taking away our freedom by spending our money on their wasteful government programs. So tomorrow we will focus again on turning the blue states red, on lowering the taxes, and on restoring freedom. This is the Freedom Show, and this is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. Thank you for joining us today.